Huddy.
I put on a pair of gloves myself and grabbed one of the other tools. I think it was a hard rake, but I'm not entirely sure. Whatever it was, I grabbed it, and I joined Eddie and George. A few seconds later, or maybe it was a minute, I don't know, time stopped meaning anything. I looked around and Shirley was there too. She put on her own gloves and then grabbed Archie's post hole digger. Her hair had come loose and was hanging down around her face. She looked at me like Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. We all remembered to put on gloves, but we were all crazy, completely nuts. The look of it, the gibbering, keening, screeching sound of it, even the way Mr. D was howling and whining, all of that made us crazy. I'd forgotten about the overturned tanker and George Stankowski trying to get the kids into the school bus and drive them to safety. The angry young man Eddie and George Morgan had brought in. I think I forgot there was any world at all outside that stinking little shed. I was screaming as I swung the rake, plunging the tines into the thing on the floor again and again and again. The others were screaming too. We stood around it in a circle, beating and bludgeoning and cutting it to pieces. We were screaming at it to die, and it wouldn't die. It seemed as if it would never die. If I could forget anything, any part of it, I'd forget this. At the very end, just before it finally did die, it raised the stump of the thing in its chest. The stump was trembling like an old man's hand. There were eyes in the stump, some of them hanging from shiny threads of gristle by then. Maybe those threads were optic nerves? I don't know. Anyway, the stump rose up for just a moment. In the center of my head, I saw myself. I saw all of us standing around in a circle and looking down, looking like murderers at the grave of their victim, and I saw how strange and alien we were, how horrible we were. In that moment, I felt its awful confusion. Not its fear, because it wasn't afraid. Not its innocence, because it wasn't innocent. Or guilty, for that matter. What it was confused. Did it know where it was? I don't think so. Did it know why Mr. Dillon had attacked it and why we were killing it? Yes, it knew that much. We were doing it because we were so different. So different and so horrible that its many eyes could hardly see us, could hardly hold onto our images as we surrounded it, screaming and chopping and cutting and hitting. And then it finally stopped moving. The stub of the trunk thing in its chest dropped back down again. Its eyes stopped twitching and just stared. We stood there, Eddie and George, side by side, panting. Shirley and I were across from them, on the other side of that thing. And Mr. D was behind us, panting and whining. Shirley dropped the post hole digger, and when it hit the concrete, I saw a plug of the dead thing's yellow flesh caught in it like a piece of diseased dirt. Her face was bone white, except for two wild, bright patches of red in her cheeks, and another blooming on her throat like a birthmark. "Huddy," she whispered. "What?" I asked. I could hardly talk, my throat was that dry. "Huddy."
"What, goddammit?"
"It could think," she whispered. Her eyes were big and horrified, swimming with tears. "We killed a thinking being. That's murder."
"Bullshit's what that is," George said. "Even if it's not, what damn good does it do to go on about it?"
Whining, but not in the same urgent way as before, Mr. Dillon pushed in between me and Shirley. There were big bald patches in the fur on his neck and back and chest, as if he had the mange. The tip of one ear seemed to be singed clean off. He stretched out his neck and sniffed the corpse of the thing lying beside the roll-up door.
"Grab him out of there," George said. "Nah, he's all right," I said.
As Dee scented at the limp and now unmoving tangle of pink tendrils on the thing's head,
He whined again. Then he lifted his leg and pissed on the severed piece of trunk or horn or whatever it was. With that done, he backed away, still whining. I could hear a faint hiss. The smell of cabbage was getting stronger, and the yellow color was fading from the creature's flesh. It was turning white. Tiny, almost invisible ribbons of steam were starting to drift up. That's where the worst of the stench was in that rising vapor. The thing had started to decompose, like the rest of the stuff that had come through. "Shirley, go back inside," I said. "You got a 99 to handle." She blinked rapidly like somebody who's just coming to. "The tanker," she said. "George S., oh Lord, I forgot!" "Take the dog with you," I said. "Yes, all right." She paused. "What about..." She gestured at the tools scattered on the concrete, the ones we used to kill the creatures that lay against the door, mangled and screaming. Screaming what? For mercy? Would it or its kind have accorded mercy to one of us had our positions been reversed? I don't think so. But of course I wouldn't. Would I? Because you have to get through first one night, and then another, and then a year of nights, and then 10. You have to be able to turn off the lights and lie there in the dark. You have to believe you only did what would have been done to you. You have to arrange your thoughts because you know you can only live with the lights on so much of the time. "I don't know, Shirley," I said. I felt very tired, and the smell of the rotting cabbage was making me sick to my stomach. "What the fuck does it matter? It's not like there's going to be a trial or an inquest or anything official. Go on inside. You're the police communication officer, so communicate." She nodded jerkily. "Come on, Mr. Dillon." I wasn't sure Dee would go with her, but he did, walking neatly behind one of Shirley's brown, low-heeled shoes. He kept whining, though. And just before they went out the side door, he kind of shivered all over, as if he caught a chill.
"We ought to get out, too," George said to Eddie.
He started to rub at his eyes, realized he was still wearing his gloves, and he stripped them off.
"We got a prisoner to take care of."
Eddie looked as surprised as Shirley had when I reminded her that she had business to deal with over in Poteenville.
"Forgot all about that loudmouthed son of a bitch," he said.
"He broke his nose, George. I heard it." "Yeah," George said. "Oh, what a shame." Eddie grinned. You could see him trying to pull it back. It widened instead. They have a way of doing that, even under the worst of circumstances. Especially under the worst of circumstances. "Go on," I said. "Take care of him."
"Come with us," Eddie said. "You shouldn't be in here alone."
"Why not? It's dead, isn't it?"
"That's not."
Eddie lifted his chin in the Buick's direction.
"Goddamn fake car's hinky. Still hinky. And I mean to the max.
Don't you feel it?"
"I feel something," George said. "Probably just reaction from dealing with that..."
He gestured at the dead creature.
"That whatever it was."
"No," Eddie said. "What you feel's coming from the goddamn Buick, not that dead thing. It breathes. That's what I think. Whatever that car really is, it breathes."
"I don't think it's safe to be here, Hud. Not for any of us."
"Eh, you're overreacting." "The hell I am. It breathes."
It blew that pink-headed thing out on the exhale the way you blow a booger out of your nose when you sneeze, and now it's getting ready to suck back in. I tell you, I can feel it.
"Look," I said, "I just want one quick look around, okay? Then I'm going to grab the tarp and cover up that." I jerked my thumb at what we killed. "Anything more complicated can wait for Tony and Kurt. They're the experts."
But calming him down was impossible. He was working himself into a state.
"You can't let him near that fake car until after it sucks in again."
Eddie looked balefully at the Buick.
"And you better be ready for an argument on the subject. The Sarge will want to come in, and Kurt will want to come in even more, but you can't let them because..."
I know, I said. It's getting ready to suck back in. You could feel it.
We ought to get you your own 800 number, Eddie. You could make your fortune reading palms over the phone.
Yeah, go ahead, laugh. You think Ennis Rafferty's laughing wherever he is?
I'm telling you what I know. Whether you like it or not, it's breathing. It's what it's been doing all along.
This time when it sucks back, it's gonna be hard.
Tell you what, let me and George help you with the tarp.
We'll cover the thing up together, and then we'll all go out together.
That seemed like a bad idea to me, although I didn't know exactly why.
Eddie, I can handle this, swear to God.
Also, I want to take a few pictures of Mr. E.T. before he rots away to nothing but stone crab soup.
Quit it, George said. He was looking a little green. Sorry. I'll be out in 2 shakes of a lamb's tail. Go on now, you guys. Take care of your subject.
Eddie was staring at the Buick, standing there on its big, smooth, white wall tires. Its trunk opened so its ass end looked like the front end of a crocodile.
I hate that thing, he said. For 2 cents.
George was heading for the door by then, and Eddie followed without finishing what he'd do for 2 cents. Wasn't that hard to figure out anyway.
The smell of the decaying creature was getting worse by the minute, and I remembered the puff pack Curtis had worn when he'd come in here to investigate the plant that looked like a lily. I thought it was still in the hutch. There was a Polaroid camera, too, or had been the last time I looked.
Very faint from the parking lot, I heard George calling to Shirley, asking if she was all right. She called back and said that she was. A second or two later, Eddie yelled, "Fuck!" at the top of his voice. Another country heard from. He sounded pissed like a bear. I figure his prisoner, probably high on drugs and with a broken nose to boot, had upchucked in the back of Unit 6. Well, so what? There are worse things than having a prisoner blow chunks in your ride. Once, while I was assisting at the scene of a 3-car collision over in Patchen, I stashed a drunk driver who caused it all in the back of my unit for safekeeping while I set out some road flares. When I returned, I discovered that my subject had taken off his shirt and taken a shit in it. And then he used one of his sleeves as a squeeze tube. Now, you have to imagine a baker decorating a cake to get what I'm trying to describe here. He wrote his name on both side windows in the back. He was trying to do the rear window, too, only he ran out of his special brown icing. When I asked him why he wanted to do such a nasty, goddamn thing, he looked up at me with that cockeyed hauteur only a long-time drunk could manage and said,
"It's a nasty goddamn world, trooper."
Anyway, I didn't think Eddie yelling was important, and I went back to the hutch where we kept our supplies without bothering to check on him. I was more than half convinced the puff pack would be gone, but it was still on the shelf, wedged between the box of blank videotapes and a pile of Field and Stream magazines. Some tidy soul had even tucked it into a plastic evidence bag to keep the dust off. Taking it down, I remembered how crazy Kurt had looked on the day I first saw him wearing this gadget. Kurt also wearing a plastic barber smock and a blue bathing cap and red galoshes. "You're beautiful. Wave to your adoring fans," I told him. I put the mask to my mouth and nose, almost sure what would come out would be unbreathable, but it was air all right. Stale as weak old bread, but not actually moldy, if you know what I mean. Better than the stench in the shed, certainly. I grabbed the battered old Polaroid one-shot from the nail where it was hanging by the strap. I backed out of the hutch and... this could be nothing but hindsight. I'll be the first to admit it. I think I saw movement. Just a flash of movement. Not from the vicinity of the shed, though, because I was looking right at that. This was more of a corner-of-the-eye phenomenon. Something in our backfield. In the high grass. I probably thought it was Mr. Dillon, maybe rolling around trying to get that thing's smell off. Well, it wasn't. Mr. Dillon wasn't up to rolling around by then. By then, poor old D was busy dying.
I went back to the shed, breathing through the mask. And although I hadn't felt what Eddie was talking about before, this time it came through loud and clear. It was like being outside the shed for a few moments had freshened it for me, or attuned me to it. The Buick wasn't flashing purple lightning or glowing or humming. It was only sitting there, but there was a sense of liveliness to it that was unmistakable. You could feel it hovering just over your skin, like the lightest touch of a breeze huffing on the hairs of your forearms. And I thought, now this is crazy. But I thought, what if the Buick's nothing but another version of what I'm wearing on my face right now? What if it's nothing but a puff pack? What if the thing wearing it has exhaled, and now its chest is lying flat, but in a second or two... Even with the puff pack, the smell of the dead creature was enough to make my eyes water. Brian Cole and Jackie O'Hara, two of the handier build-em and fix-em-up fellows on the roster back then, had installed an overhead fan the year before, and I flipped the switch as I passed it. I took three pictures, and then the one shot was out of film. I never checked the load. Stupid. I tucked the photos into my back pocket, put the camera down on the floor, and then went to get the tarp. As I bent and grabbed it, I realized that I'd taken the camera but walked out of the hutch right past the looped length of bright yellow rope. I should have taken it and cinched the loop end of it around my waist, tied the other end to the big old hook Curtis had mounted left of Shed B's side door just for that purpose. But I didn't do that. The rope was too goddamn bright to miss, but I missed it anyway. Funny, huh? And there I was where I had no business to be on my own. But I was on my own. I wasn't wearing a security line either. I'd walked right past it, maybe because something wanted me to walk right past it. There was a dead E.T. on the floor. The air was full of a lively, chilly, gathering feeling. I think it crossed my mind that if I disappeared, my wife and Ennis Rafferty's sister could join up forces. I think I might have laughed out loud at that. I can't remember for sure, but I do remember being struck humorous by something. The global absurdity of the situation, maybe. The thing we killed had turned entirely white. It was steaming like dry ice. The eyes on the severed piece still seemed to be staring at me, even though by then they'd started to melt and run. I was as afraid as I've ever been in my life. Afraid the way you are when you're in a situation where you could really die and you know it. That sense of something about to breathe, to suck in, was so strong it made my skin crawl. But I was grinning too. Big, old grin. Not quite laughing, but almost. Feeling humorous. I tossed the tarp over Mr. E.T. and started backing out of the shed. Forgot the Polaroid entirely. Left it sitting there on the concrete. I was almost at the door when I looked at the Buick, and some force pulled me toward it. Am I sure it was its force? Actually, I'm not. It might have just been the fascination deadly things have for us. The edge and the drop. How the muzzle of a gun looks back at us like an eye when we turn it this way and that. Even the point of a knife starts to look different if the hour's late and everyone else in the house has gone to sleep. All this was below the level of thinking, though. On the level of thinking, I just decided I couldn't go out and leave the Buick with its trunk open. It just looked too, I don't know, too getting ready to breathe. Or to bite. Something like that. I was still smiling. Might even have laughed a little. I took 8 steps. Or maybe it was a dozen. I guess it could have been as many as a dozen. I was telling myself there was nothing foolish about what I was doing. Eddie J. was nothing but an old lady mistaking feelings for facts. I reached for the trunk lid. I meant just to slam it and scat, or so I told myself. But then I looked inside, and I said one of those things you say when you're surprised. I can't remember which one. It might have been, "Well, I be dog," or "I'll be switched," because there was something in there. Lying on the trunk's plain brown carpeting, it looked like a transistor radio from the late 50s or early 60s. There was even a shiny stub of what could have been an antenna sticking up from it. I reached into the trunk and picked the gizmo up. I had a good laugh over it, too. I felt like I was in a dream, or tripping on some chemical. And all the time, I knew it was closing in on me, getting ready to take me. I didn't know if it got in us the same way, but probably. Yeah. I was standing in front of that open trunk, no rope on me, and no one to pull me back. And something was getting ready to pull me in, to breathe me in like cigarette smoke. And I didn't give shit one. All I cared about was what I found in the trunk. It might have been some sort of communication device, that's what it looked like, but it might have been something else entirely. Where the monster kept its prescription drugs. Some sort of musical instrument. Maybe even a weapon. It was the size of a cigarette pack, but a lot heavier. Heavier than a transistor radio or a Walkman, too. There were no dials or knobs or levers on it. The stuff it was made of didn't look or feel like either metal or plastic. It had a fine-grained texture, not exactly unpleasant, but organic, like cured cowhide. I touched the rod sticking out of it, and it retracted into a hole on top. I touched the hole, and the rod came back out. I touched the rod again, and this time, nothing happened. Not then, not ever. Although ever, for what we call the radio, wasn't very long. After a week or so, the surface of it began to pit and corrode. It was in an evidence bag with a Ziploc top, but that didn't matter. A month later, the radio looked like something that's been left out in the wind and rain for about 80 years. By the following spring, it was nothing but a bunch of gray fragments lying in the bottom of a baggie. The antenna, if that's what it was, never moved again. Not so much as a silly millimeter. I thought of Shirley saying, "We killed a thinking being," and George saying, "That was bullshit." Except it wasn't bullshit. The bat and the fish hadn't come equipped with things that looked like transistor radios because they had been animals. Today's visitor, which we'd hacked to pieces with tools we'd taken from the pegboard, had been something quite different. However loathsome it had seemed to us, no matter how instinctively we'd... what was that word? We'd repudiated it. Shirley was right. It had been a thinking being. We killed it nevertheless, hacked it to pieces even as it lay on the concrete, holding out the severed stump of its trunk in surrender, and screaming for the mercy it must have known we'd never give it, couldn't give it. And that didn't horrify me. What did was a vision of the shoe on the other foot, of Ennis Rafferty falling into the midst of other creatures like this, things with yellow knobs for heads, under tangled masses of pink ropes that might have been hair. I saw him dying beneath their flailing acid-lined trunks and hooked talons, trying to scream for mercy, and choking on air he could barely breathe, and when he lay dead before them, dead and already beginning to rot. Had one of them worked his weapon out of its holster? Had they stood there looking at it under an alien sky of some unimaginable color, as puzzled by the gun as I had been by the radio? Had one of them said, "We just killed a thinking being," to which the other had responded, "That's bullshit"? As I thought of these things, I also thought I ought to get out of there right away, unless I wanted to investigate such questions in person, that was. So, what happened next? I've never told anyone that, but I might as well tell now. Seems foolish to come this far and then hold back. I decided to get in the trunk. I could see myself doing it. There would be plenty of space. You know how big the trunks of those old cars were. When I was a kid, we used to joke that Buicks and Cadillacs and Chryslers were mop cars because there was enough room for either two Polacks or three guineas in the trunk. Plenty of space. Old Huddy Roya would get in, lie on his side, and reach up and pull the trunk closed, softly, so it just made the faintest click. And then he'd lie there in the dark, breathing the stale air from the puff pack and holding the radio to his chest. There wouldn't be much air left in that little tank, but there'd be enough. Old Huddy would just curl up and lie there and keep smiling, and then, pretty soon, something interesting would happen. I haven't thought of this in years, unless it was in the kind of dreams you can't remember when you wake up. The ones you just know were bad because your heart is pounding and your mouth is dry and your tongue tastes like a burnt fuse. The last time I thought consciously about standing there in front of the Buick Roadmaster's trunk was when I heard George Morgan had taken his own life. I thought of him out there in his garage, sitting down on the floor, maybe listening to the kids playing baseball under the lights over on McClurg Field around on the other side of the block, and then with his can of beer finished, taking up the gun and looking at it. We might have switched over to a Beretta by then, but George kept his Ruger, said it just felt right in his hand. I thought of him turning it this way and that, looking into its eye. Every gun has an eye. Anyone who's ever looked into one knows that. I thought of him putting the barrel between his teeth and feeling the hard little bump of the gun sight against the roof of his mouth, tasting the oil, maybe even poking into the muzzle with the tip of his tongue, the way you might tongue the mouthpiece of a trumpet when you get ready to blow. Sitting there in the corner of the garage, still tasting that last can of beer, also tasting the gun oil and the steel, licking the little hole in the muzzle. The eye, the slug comes out at twice the speed of sound, riding a pad of hot expanding gases. Sitting there, smelling the grass caked under the lawn boy and a little spilled gasoline. Hearing the kids cheer across the block. Thinking of how it felt to hit a woman with 2 tons of police cruiser, the thud and slew of it. Seeing the drops of blood appear on the windshield like the debut of a biblical curse, and hearing the dry gourd-like rattle of something caught in one of the wheel wells, what turned out to be one of her sneakers. I thought of all that, and I think of how it was for him because I know how it was for me. I knew it was going to be horrible, but I didn't care, because it would be kind of funny, too. That's why I was smiling. I didn't want to get away. I don't think George did either. In the end, when you really decide to do it, it's like falling in love. It's like your wedding night. And I had decided to do it. Saved by the bell? That's the saying. But I was saved by a scream. Shirley's. At first it was just a high shriek, and then there were words. Help! Please! Help me! Please, please, help me! It was like being slapped out of a trance. I took 2 big steps away from the Buick's trunk, wavering like a drunk, hardly able to believe what I'd been on the verge of. Then Shirley screamed again, and I heard Eddie yell, "What's wrong with him, George? What's happening to him?" I turned, and I ran out the shed door. Yeah, saved by the scream. That's me.